I'm Tavis Smiley, and we are thrilled to have you tuned into our program today, and especially and particularly in this hour, as we talk about then and now and some lessons that we can learn even today from American history. In this hour, I'm pleased to be joined by historian and Columbia professor. I didn't plan it that way. It just works out that way, that we've had two guests back to back who both teach at Columbia. Sometimes it just happens that way. It's a brilliant institution, and so we're honored to have them both. Just had a conversation with our friend Rashid Khalidi, professor at Columbia, and now we're joined in this hour by historian Tim Naftali, who's actually in L.A. at the moment, live with us in studio, but also a professor at Columbia in New York City, as he helps us to unpack the lasting impact of the Watergate scandal 50 years ago this year when President Richard Milhouse Nixon resigned in an unprecedented manner for a United States president. Before we commence this conversation for the hour with the lessons that we can learn all these years later, as I said earlier, with a guy potentially on the ballot who's violated all kinds of rules, and in many ways you keep hearing that word unprecedented being used in connection to Donald Trump, because every day something unprecedented happens with this guy who is the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party. The timing, I think, could not be more propitious for us to look back 50 years ago and to bring it forward. And we'll do that for the hour. Before we commence the conversation, though, hear now the voice of Richard Nixon resigning 50 years ago this year.
Good evening. This is the 37th time I have spoken to you from this office, where so many decisions have been made that shaped the history of this nation. Each time I have done so to discuss with you some matter that I believe affected the national interest. In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation. Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. As long as there was such a base, I felt strongly that it was necessary to see the constitutional process through to its conclusion, that to do otherwise would be unfaithful to the spirit of that deliberately difficult process and a dangerously destabilizing precedent for the future. But with the disappearance of that base, I now believe that the constitutional purpose has been served, and there is no longer a need for the process to be prolonged. I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved. And my family unanimously urged me to do so. But the interests of the nation must always come before any personal considerations. From the discussions I have had with congressional and other leaders, I have concluded that because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation will require. I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad. To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
50 years ago this month, President Richard Nixon was named as an unindicted co-conspirator, setting off a long, tense spring and summer until those words from him in August announcing his historic resignation. We'll talk about the impact 50 years later for the hour when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Hope, agency, dignity. This is Tavis Smiley.
Can you dig it?
Come on!
May Fresh Daily in the Mert Park,
Los Angeles, California.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and Columbia professor and historian Tim Naftali, who joins us live in studio. In case you've just tuned in, you missed it, but I hope you didn't miss it. We just played, and Professor Naftali was saying to me a moment ago, Tavis, I'm glad you played that. Nobody ever plays the full clip. They'll just play that last part. I now therefore resign. I wanted to play a full 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes, frankly, to give you a sense of the way that Nixon at least tried to frame his resignation. That said, Professor Naftali, first of all, it's good to see you. How are you today, sir?
Very well. Nice to be here, Tavis.
Good
Thanks
to have
for
you in
me.
Studio. Good to have you here. So let me just pass the mic to you and start with this. When you sit and listen, as we did together, to the words of Richard Nixon 50 years ago this year, you heard what?
Well, what I heard was someone who understood that he'd lost his base. And when we talk about January 6th, I think it'll be very important for us to discuss how ultimately the reaction to January 6th is different in our country in this political moment than the reaction was to learning the revelations of Watergate back in 1974. But there's something else that I heard, and it has to do with the importance of the individual at the center of our pyramid of power. Mm-hmm. For all his flaws, and Richard Nixon had enormous flaws, which we can talk about, he did have a sense of shame. He did have a sense and a sense of history and legacy. And he had come reluctantly and I would say bitterly to the conclusion in early August of 1974 that he could not stay in office without tearing down the Constitution. And again, for all his flaws, for all of his willingness to abuse power, and I hope we will talk about that, one thing he did not want to do was be the one who tore down the system, the constitutional system. And so he reluctantly concluded he could not fight the Supreme Court, which had ruled in U.S. v. Nixon that he had to turn over the tapes that the special prosecutor was asking for. And then when members of Congress made clear to him, particularly Southern Democrats, because mm-hmm. that's an era when a lot of folks who love the dog whistle, right, mm-hmm. they begin to shift to the Republican Party, but they haven't yet, so they're still Democrats. Nixon thought those people, because of the Southern strategy, would work to save his position. Mm-hmm. They turned on him, too. So when he realized he was going to lose, he was going to be impeached in the House and then convicted in the Senate, he pulls out. And maybe some of your listeners were thinking about a very different political figure. But Nixon, in that speech, and I'm glad you ran the clip, said, you know, I didn't want to spend the next few months seeking vindication. Mm-hmm. I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. Well, who does that make you think of?
Mm-hmm.
What happens when a powerful figure, a political figure, decides to put everything at risk in order to retain power. Mm-hmm. And Nixon said, I'm not going to do that. Yeah. I'm going to leave office. And I think it reminds us all of the significance of the personality and character of the person that we elect to put in the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. And in Nixon's case, for all his flaws, for all the crimes he committed, there was a red line he would not cross, and he didn't, and the constitutional system came out of the Watergate moment stronger.
There's a lot you've said now that I want to give you a chance to unpack the rest of the hour. I'm glad we got this hour because there's a lot to deal with. Let me start with this, and I'm not naive in asking this either. What does it mean to you that Donald Trump does not have the sense of shame that Richard Nixon did? What does that mean
for you? Look, I don't need to tell Americans, especially not your audience, the flaws of the constitutional system that the founding fathers, the founding generation, put in place.
You mean these pro-slavery documents?
Oh, pulled it. I don't need to.
Yeah.
But that generation did believe that leaders had a sense of shame. Mm-hmm. Because when you read what they write about why they put impeachment in the Constitution, they understood the possibility that bad people, in that era they would say bad men, mm-hmm. would be elected. And they wanted a way to get rid of those people before the next election. They also assumed that if they committed a crime, they would be held accountable as an ex-president to the legal system. There's no doubt in the writings of Madison and Jefferson that they anticipated that there would be a trial of that person after they left office. So they believed in something called virtue. Again, I'm not going to lecture, even though I spent some time lecturing in my career. I'm not going to lecture people about virtue and the flawed virtue of the founding generation, but mm-hmm. they believed that there was a sense of being, if you will, quote unquote, a gentleman, and that you expected political leaders to be virtuous. So they anticipated shame. When you have a powerful person who has no shame, then they don't care if their lies are found out, because they're convinced that whatever group of people they have behind them or whatever force they have behind them will allow them to jump over the hurdle that their lie may have created for them. If they have no sense of shame, they don't care about the effect on their family. They don't care about the effect on their followers of their frauds and their lies. So in one sense, shame is a constitutional protection. It's not written anywhere.
Yeah.
It's one of those invisible norms. And when you have a leader who doesn't have that, that's one less protection against authoritarianism.
I could argue, that it's not just Mr. Trump who has no sense of shame. One could argue, of course, if one made this argument, as I'm about to make, one might be accused of demonizing those persons who support Mr. Trump. So be it. One could argue that those who support him also have no sense of shame. And that's an indictment, again, not just on the individual or the gentleman, to quote you, but it's an indictment on many people who make up this demos. It's an indictment on many of our fellow citizens. And when you do that, even though you're telling the truth, that gets you into a lot of trouble in this country. That makes sense?
It makes sense to me. I one of the challenges as an analyst that I have is I don't know how engaged most people are with politics, since I spend my time mm-hmm. analyzing politics, listening to political things, reading about it. Mm-hmm. So I tend not to try to indict people outside of Washington, because mm-hmm. I just don't know. You know, they have their own lives. Sure. They have their own challenges. But I'm happy to talk about the responsibility of elected officials in Washington who know the truth.
Right.
Those people. And by the way, this is one of the great differences between 1974 and today. Mm-hmm. In Washington in 1974, you had Republicans who had been lied to by Nixon, who were angry at Nixon, mm-hmm. and made it clear to Nixon they would not support him in the impeachment process that was likely to occur. The difference decades later is that the Trump phenomenon, Trump and his movement, they were able to create some fear among elected Republicans. Now, some elected Republicans were on the Trump train. That we know that. But others, as made clear in this really interesting biography of Mitt Romney that was based on Mitt Romney's diaries, they were just fearful. There were members of the Senate, and you think, why would a U.S. senator be fearful? But they were fearful of the consequences for them and their family of voting to convict Trump in the second impeachment. Well, that's a very different political environment.
But let's unpack
in 1974.
Let's unpack that. They're fearful because, as you and I both know, they don't want to be primaried.
They don't want to be primary.
They're fearful because they want to hold on to their seats. So they just.
Although I will say, I mean, again, I'm not defending or justifying this.
Because, I get it.
Because you know what? If you run for office in this country and you want to be senator, you read that Constitution before you become senator, and if you're not up to it, don't do it.
Exactly.
Don't. If you're not willing.
Yeah.
Because this is really important. I mean, I can't stress this enough. The country, and Nixon said this, and it took him a long time to come around, but, you know, the country matters more than the party, whatever the party is. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter more than your principles, by the way, but it may, I would hope the country and your principles are could be generally aligned.
Sure.
But if you're not willing to act like a constitutional officer in an impeachment process, what that means is you're not thinking about your party, the president's party, or the group against the president, but you're thinking about the country and what a high crime would be, which is the crime against the system, mm-hmm. this constitutional system. If you're not prepared for that, if you're not strong enough to do that, you really shouldn't run for senator.
But you're making my point. My point is that these persons were so fearful of Donald Trump, but not really. What they were fearful of, that Donald Trump would primary them. And so the fear is the fear of losing my seat. I agree with you that each of us should live our lives by a certain set of immutable principles. And those principles that your mama and daddy help instill in you ought to be greater than party, ought to be greater than any of that. But when what matters most to you is holding on to your seat.
Yes, then you become a coward.
Exactly. So you're not really afraid of Donald Trump as much as you are. You're afraid of being primary and losing your seat. And Donald Trump is a cog in that wheel.
Although I will say again, just Romney noted, and Romney didn't have this money. He's a very wealthy man, and but Romney had actually paid for full time security for his family, and there were a number. I don't know how many Republican senators, but were actually physically fearful.
No, I can see that. I don't want to. I got 3 minutes here before we go forward, and we got more to talk about in this hour. But let me just do this in these 3 minutes that we have now, because I don't want to let you off the hook on this. I understand your role as an analyst, and we see you on CNN and you know other places doing what you do so well. You're a brilliant analyst, and I'm honored to have you on this program offering your analysis. But I don't want to let you off the hook on this. I understand your role is to talk about, to unpack, to dissect the role of elected officials, as you put it. The point I'm making, though, is that if Donald Trump has no shame, then the voters who support him must also have no shame because they are enablers. And that's my problem. My problem is that these voters are not just voters, Professor Naftali. These voters have become enablers. You can't argue that point, sir.
Well, I'm not here to defend MAGA world.
Yeah. But they are enablers, though. Yeah, that's all I'm saying.
Effectively, of course, in the end.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, one of the great, and this is a tragedy. Mm-hmm. This is one of the great tragedies is that as a result of 9/11, as a result of January 6th, mm-hmm. different crisis,
yeah.
different perpetrators.
We've had a few.
As a result of January 6th,
yeah.
Donald Trump should have been disqualified, not by the Constitution. That's a whole different debate. I'm not a lawyer, but disqualified just politically. People should have said enough. And those who didn't and now form the army in support of him have seemed to not grasp the responsibilities of citizenship and the whole nature of our constitutional system. And yes, they bear responsibility for that. If you are supporting Donald Trump, despite January 6th, you have to ask yourselves, do you believe that undertaking an insurrection to overturn an election is a legitimate form of speech or activity? And I don't think it is, and most Americans will agree it's not. But there are people in the Trump world who believe that it is legitimate. And those people are responsible for what they're saying and doing.
50 years ago this year, Richard Milhouse Nixon resigned as president of these United States. It was historic. It was unprecedented. It continues in many ways to reverberate half a century later. We're talking about that in this hour with Columbia professor, historian Tim Naftali. You're listening, and I'm glad about it, to Tavis Smiley.
What's your quarrel with the world?
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Let's get back to more of this rich dialogue with Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley, in Columbia historian and Professor Tim Naftali, who joins us in this hour as we continue our dialogue now about the resignation of Richard Nixon 50 years ago this year. In fact, 50 years ago this month, President Nixon was named as an unindicted co-conspirator, as I said earlier, setting off a long and tense spring and summer until he ultimately resigned in August of 1974. So as we move toward August of this year, there'll be a number of conversations and documentaries and books. I'm just jumping out now, getting started. But there'll be all kinds of analysis as we move between now and August the 8th of this year, the actual day that Richard Nixon stepped inside the Oval Office and spoke to the nation live, resigning the presidency and declaring that the next day, the following day, August the 9th at 12 noon, Gerald Ford would be sworn in as president. We all know how that story kind of turned out. But it's been 50 years, believe it or not, since all of this happened, and we are looking back a half century ago at the lessons that we can learn today from what happened then. Let me just ask you, Professor Naftali, whether or not, other than the fact that Nixon eventually saw the light and stepped aside, which I think was a good thing, beyond that, did anything good come out of Watergate?
A number of good things came out of Watergate. One was that you had a bipartisan vote in support of articles of impeachment. There were a group of Republicans who joined the Democrats. And what they determined was that abuse of power was an impeachable offense, and an abuse of power did not have to be a crime. So in other words, it didn't have to be a crime on the books that the president had actually violated by abusing power, but by their actions, they challenged our constitutional system. So that would involve sicking the IRS against one of your enemies. Nixon had attempted to engage in more abuse of power than he actually achieved. He was stopped by some people in the bureaucracy. He was stopped by some Republican appointees. But the tapes make clear that he really, really wanted to abuse more power and hurt his enemies. But let's talk about some other things because they're relevant to today. The Presidential Records Act, the act that Donald Trump will say allegedly, because he's going to be on trial for it, but the evidence is pretty damning, that he violated, that Presidential Records Act, which make presidential records our documents, we as Americans, as opposed to being the private property of a president, that's a consequence of Watergate. Certain privacy provisions were tightened. The president, as a result of Watergate and what was learned from some congressional investigations of presidential misdeeds which followed, presidents had to seek a court warrant if they wanted to wiretap us for national security purposes. Until the early 70s, if a president decided you were a national security threat, he could wiretap you. That's how John F. Kennedy, for example, through his brother Bobby, decided to wiretap Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. That stopped, and that's what created the FISA court. Well, after 9/11, for a couple of years, the Bush administration waived that, and we returned to a sort of an imperial presidency similar to Nixon. I would argue a deeply flawed one, but even Bush did not engage in the same abuses of power that Nixon had. In any case, so there's the Freedom of Information Act gets tightened after the after Watergate. Presidential Records Act gets passed. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court is established so that you always have to go for a warrant for a national security wiretap. There were some provisions put in place to try to eliminate some of the campaign finance abuses that Nixon had committed. You had it wasn't solely because of Watergate, but it's part of the story. Congress finally stepped up to the plate and established rules for intelligence oversight of the intelligence community as a result of the misdeeds from Vietnam to Watergate. So a lot of very important limitations on presidential power emerged out of the Watergate experience.
The most fascinating thing that you said in running that list, and it was a formidable list. The most fascinating thing you said to me, I heard you say at least in that rundown, was that Republicans joined Democrats. Let me repeat that phrase. Republicans joined Democrats. You know exactly where I'm going. There ain't no way in the world that in this moment you'd have Republicans joining Democrats to accomplish, to achieve any of those objectives like we saw after Watergate 50 years ago. I don't need to color that much more. What do you make of that distinction, that difference? A half century later, there are no more moderate Republicans.
Well, Joe Lieberman, who died yesterday, who was Al Gore's running mate in 2000, Joe Lieberman talked about an era in Washington when Republicans and Democrats found ways to work together, like the Clean Air Act of 1990, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the early 2000s. These required bipartisanship. So did the infrastructure bill just recently passed under Joe Biden. And what Lieberman talked about, and others like him, but generally they're retired, or was that the Washington community no longer liked each other, that they didn't. Now, there's always a problem when people are too cozy, right? Because then you get deals. But then if no one's cozy, if no one trusts each other, then you don't get any deals and you can compromise. And we have a political culture now where compromise is seen as a sign of weakness. And I say this to your listeners, because I want everybody has to make up their decision, their mind themselves on how they want to be represented. Do you want someone to go to Washington and do exactly what you told them to do? Or do you have some room when you think about representation to have somebody go to Washington, get access to materials, learn a little bit more, find out a little bit more, and maybe on their own decide, you know what, there's a dilemma here. I'm gonna compromise a little on this to achieve that. We're in a climate now where that approach will get you primaried, and 30 to 50 seats, it's assumed, in the House of Representatives are seats where it could go either way. The rest of the seats, and they're 435, they're gerrymandered, or there's the one party is so far ahead that the real election is the primary.
I've got two words for you and then a question. My two words for you are Liz Cheney.
Yeah.
Those are my two words for you. When you try to do the right thing, you don't just get primaried, you get Liz Cheney'd. Liz Cheney'd.
Travis, if I may say this quickly. Sure. In our political system, political results speak louder often than principles. And my fear about the 2024 election is that should Donald Trump be reelected, people are going to take the wrong lessons from his misdeeds, and they're going to learn you can overcome those. That he's either a coward on January 6th, or he is an instigator of violence. We'll let the courts decide, right? Mm-hmm. But either way, that should disqualify him from ever holding the highest office in this country. If he gets reelected, it's a way of saying you get a pass. And if he gets a pass, what do young people today learn about power in this country?
I couldn't have said it better myself.
So this is, to me, why 2024 is so important.
When we come forward, I want to ask you, since you used that phrase, gerrymandering, I want to ask you how serious a threat you think gerrymandering is to the future of this democracy. That's the question. How serious a threat is gerrymandering, just as a single issue, to the future of this experiment in democracy? That and more when we come forward. Looking back 50 years ago on the resignation of Richard Nixon and all the reverberations a half a century later, you're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Interrogating and unpacking.
That's what we do around here.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley. Smiley.
Sounds
different, huh? This is Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and the Columbia professor and historian Tim Naftali talking about Richard Nixon and his resignation 50 years ago this year. It all started this month when he was indicted And it was a long summer, a long spring, long summer. And finally, August 8th, 1974, he did the right thing. 50 years later, you were talking about gerrymandering. I wondered to what extent you think, because I certainly do, that gerrymandering is a threat to our very democracy.
Yes. Yes, it's a threat to our democracy because it means that politicians don't have to fight for your vote. Mm-hmm. Because most politicians, once they win the primary, are assured of winning the general election. Certainly members of the House are.
Yeah.
And we need a country where politicians have to fight for your vote and not take power for granted.
Here's a question that we could spend literally an hour dissecting. We could spend an hour or more just on this one question. But instead of an hour, you got 2 minutes.
It's okay.
What do you think happens, and you'll take my point, I ain't got to explain it because you're brilliant. What do you think happens to the Democratic Party post Joe Biden? Whatever happens this year, post Biden, what happens to the Democratic Party?
There's going to be a debate about the future of the party, progressives and liberals. There aren't that many conservatives left in the Democratic Party, are going to be fighting it out, and it's important. Parties do this all the time. This is not something new in our political system, especially since we for a number of reasons, developed a two-party system in the 19th century. We, by the way, did not have a two-party system when the country was formed. The founding generation hated parties. They called them factions. Anyway, point is, the Democratic Party is going to find its way, and we are going to see a real debate. I mean, we saw a little bit of it in the primaries, the Clinton versus Sanders debate. And the Biden versus Sanders debate, it gave you a foretaste of what it's going to be like. It's not going to be Bernie Sanders anymore. I mean, he'll be alive, I hope, but there's a whole new young generation of progressive voices who will be making their argument. And then you have moderate and liberal Democrats who are going to respond, and there's going to be a debate. Some of it's generational, but not all of it. And that's going to be healthy for the party. I anticipate that. I see President Biden is a bridge figure to bridge the sort of his era to the present. And we'll see, should he win, he'll have another term to continue managing our country, leading our country. But I assure you, during those 4 years, the next 4 years, there will be this debate going on in the Democratic Party about the future. Kamala Harris certainly will be part of that discussion. She may or may not be the leader when the term is over, but she'll be part of the conversation.
What you call a healthy debate inside the party, others would call it a bloodletting. I'll leave that where it is. He calls it a healthy debate. Others would call it a bloodletting. You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
For all the freedom-loving folk, this is Tavis Smiley.
I feel like freedom.
Ready to re-examine your assumptions and expand your inventory of ideas? More of Tavis Smiley coming your way right now.
4 minutes left with Columbia professor and historian Tim Natale. I can squeeze in a couple things right quick here. Again, another one of these questions we could spend hours talking about. I wonder whether or not any of what we have talked about in this hour, and there's a lot of it, might be better served. The American people might be better served if we had more choices. That's my way of asking what you think of third parties, sir.
I think that Americans would be better served if they had more choices at the state and local level. That's how parties change. That's how they certainly changed the 19th century. I think the challenge at the national level, it's not that, first of all, let's make it clear that there is no arbiter of who runs. There are rules. You follow the rules. You get on the ballot. That's how it works.
Exactly.
Okay, it's not up to me or you or anybody else to say, you can't. The challenge, though, at the national level is that because of the nature of the electoral system that we have, the two major party candidates have a much greater chance of winning. And if you are nervous about one of those candidates winning, but you don't like 25 or 40% of the platform of the other person, the problem you face, the dilemma is voting for your favorite collection of ideas might actually put in the White House the person you really don't want to have there. And that's the challenge of the two-party system. And I would argue that in 2024, given the consequences of electing, re-electing someone who either instigated an insurrection or was a coward in his unwillingness to protect Congress at a constitutionally fraught moment on January 6th, let alone the other abuses of power we know occurred. Yeah. That led to his second impeachment, let's not forget, that the consequences of electing that man to the White House, and I'm talking about Donald Trump, are so worrisome and potentially dangerous that is a reason to think about 2024 as really being an election between two people.
Yeah. Here's the exit question with 90 seconds to go. And I'm framing it this way because I think I'm right about this. And if I'm wrong, you can disabuse me of this. 50 years after Richard Nixon, how much worse is Trump than Nixon?
Trump is much worse than Nixon because Nixon, in the end, and it took a while, put country first. We have yet to see Donald Trump put country first.
Yet to see?
I haven't seen
as if it's going to happen somewhere in the future.
I think it's
going to
happen. I'm just look. I don't think it's gonna, look. I don't think it's going to happen. I just,
yeah.
I think there were in 1974 there were many people who thought that Richard Nixon would fight to the bitter end.
Yeah.
I think Donald Trump proved to us in 2020 and 2021 that he will fight to the bitter end despite the consequences to the country.
Yeah.
I anticipate he'll do the same now. That's the difference. Do you put someone, do you give the most powerful position, do you put in the most powerful position in our country somebody who, when worse comes to worse, thinks of himself first and not us?
Bill Clinton once famously said that every election is about the future, never about the past. And yet I enjoy talking to historians because, as we know, if you don't know where you have been, then you don't know where you're headed. And so there's always value in looking back, even as we move forward. And so I thank historian and Columbia professor Tim Naftali for coming in to help us unpack the first of a series of conversations between now and August, looking back on the historic resignation of Richard Nixon over Watergate 50 years ago this year. Professor Naftali, good to have you in. My friend, all the best to you, sir.
Thank you, Tavis.
More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward.